The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the February 14th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows a gigantic Elon Musk. He is walking through the streets of Washington, D.C. Kind of has sort of a King Kong pose. Black jeans, black T-shirt with an X on it, black overshirt, black hat. In his left hand, he's broken off the Washington Monument and carrying it around the top of it. You can see part of the Capitol building has been broken off. There's fire and smoke everywhere. And dozens of people are scattered around his feet in the street running for their lives. The headline is Musk's Rampage. How the world's richest man is dismantling the federal government. That is our first main story. We will start right there. Musk launches offensive on government agencies. What happened? Elon Musk seized control of crucial federal agencies and functions with startling speed this week, commandeering the Treasury Department's payment system, dismantling the world's largest humanitarian aid agency, and sidelining officials who attempted to stand in his way. Democrats, watchdog groups, and civil service unions were stunned at the unprecedented power flex by the unelected billionaire and his team, an initiative called the Department of Government Efficiency, which challenged Congress authority and potentially violated numerous laws. Elon Musk is seizing the power that belongs to the American people, said Senator Elizabeth Warren. Almost the entire 10,000-person workforce of USAID, which delivered $1.9 billion in food aid in 2023, was put on leave after DOGE, D-O-G-E, shuttered the agency's headquarters and seized its computer system. Musk called the agency a viper's nest of radical left Marxists and said it needed to die. President Trump said Musk, whom he tasked with downsizing government, was doing a great job. At Treasury, Musk's team gained access to payment systems that disperse trillions of dollars, including Medicare and Social Security benefits, payments to government contractors, and federal salaries. A top-ranked agency veteran was put on leave when he attempted to block them from the system, which holds sensitive data on millions of taxpayers. "It's a data breach of exponential proportion," said Mary Ellen Callahan, former chief privacy officer at Homeland Security. DOGE engineers, at least one of whom is as young as 19, have commandeered computer systems at the General Services Administration and Office of Personnel Management, and entered the offices of the Centers for Medicare and Medical Services and Veteran Administrations, the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Education. Congressional Democrats who were denied access to both Treasury and USAID headquarters assailed the Tesla and SpaceX CEOs' maneuvers as illegal and unconstitutional. "Before our very eyes, an unelected shadow government is conducting a hostile takeover of the federal government," said Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer. But Republican lawmakers either expressed support or downplayed Musk's actions. House Speaker Mike Johnson said Musk was performing a very important service for the people and should continue digging. Musk vowed he would. "We're never going to get another chance like this," he said. "It's now or never." What the columnist said: Musk is waging a largely unchecked war against the federal bureaucracy, said Jonathan Swan in the New York Times. Even some Trump administration officials who support his aims express a sense of helplessness about how to handle Musk's level of unaccountability. Some have hoped that Congress will assert itself and rein in the world's richest man, who is serving as a special government employee, a status typically given to part-time outside advisors. But the GOP response so far has been a collective shrug, said Kate Riga in Talking Points memo. Even as Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina, acknowledged Musk's action could run afoul of the Constitution, he waved off concern. Nobody should bellyache about that, he said. Many of the Doge team's actions appear to violate federal law, said Jeff Stein in the Washington Post. The group has no legal authority to wipe out a federal agency or to withhold congressionally approved funding. Its staffers have bombarded the federal workforce with offers to pay their salaries through September if they quit now, an offer it doesn't have the legal authority to honor. And Doge agents have trampled on security protocols by using private email addresses and hard drives and by refusing to identify themselves. All these things are so wildly illegal, said Georgetown Administrative Law Professor David A. Super, that I think they're assuming the system can't react to all this illegality at once. Leading Musk's strike force is a coterie of engineers barely out of college, said Victoria Elliott in Wired. We've identified six men ages 19 to 24 playing critical roles. None has government experience, and at least one seems to be a volunteer. Contrary to the administration's claim that Doge has read-only access to Treasury's payment system, a 25-year-old engineer, Marco Iles, has direct access to systems responsible for nearly all government payments, said multiple sources. With the ability to write code on these systems, Iles could do anything, said one source. Crippling USAID is a blunder that will have catastrophic consequences, said Michael A. Cohen in MSNBC.com. Musk's decapitation of the 64-year-old agency has shuttered anti-malarial programs in Uganda, anti-starvation efforts in Sudan, and an AIDS relief project that has saved tens of millions of lives. For less than 1% of federal spending, such efforts boost our security by building goodwill and reducing global instability. America First cannot morph into America Only, said Luke Moon in National Review. The vacuum we leave behind will be eagerly filled by our enemies, China in particular. There's only one word for all this, a coup, said Timothy Snyder in his Substack newsletter. If armed thugs stormed into these agencies, it had set off a panic. But today's reality is that power is more digital than physical. We have unelected actors illegally seizing power. If Musk decided to stop Treasury payments approved by Congress, it would make democracy meaningless. America needs to snap out of it, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. All of the warning lights are flashing. Nobody should underestimate the gravity of Musk's lawlessness or the damage being inflicted on our republic. If Musk isn't stopped, the current chaos, destruction, and lunacy will be merely a warm-up for the worst form of malevolent dictatorship. That's not hysteria. America is in a place we've never been, and something precious and fragile is at dire risk of being lost. Controversy of the week, tariffs. Does Trump know what he's doing? And so ends, for now, the dumbest trade war in history, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Just 48 hours after announcing a plan to slap 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada, those notorious American adversaries, President Trump this week declared the levies had been paused for 30 days. Why the change of heart? A cynic might point to the panic sell-off of U.S. stocks in the hours before the tariffs were due to take effect. But Trump claimed a victory, as he always does, and insisted his threats had persuaded Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum to deploy 10,000 troops to the U.S. border, to combat drug trafficking, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to appoint a fentanyl czar and strengthen border security. This was not a win for the art of the deal, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. The flow of fentanyl from Canada is minuscule. A mere 2 pounds of the drug was seized at the border in 2023. And the country's $1 billion border plan was first announced in December. Mexico, meanwhile, periodically agrees to send troops to the border, 10,000 of them as recently as 2021. Yes, Trump's new 10% tariff on Chinese imports appears to be holding, but his caving on the Mexico-Canada tariffs has left Trump and America looking weaker. When you understand that different tariffs have different purposes, Trump's behavior is not nearly as strange as it seems, said Orrin Cass in his Substack newsletter. The new 10% levy on China is a conventional decoupling tariff, part of a long-term effort to boost American manufacturing. The threatened tariffs against Canada and Mexico, by contrast, are negotiating tariffs. These can be very effective at extracting quick policy concessions at no economic cost, as we saw last week when the threat of a 25% tariff persuaded Colombia to accept military flights carrying deported migrants. But they also serve Trump's larger goal, putting our allies on notice that America is no longer the world's benevolent hegemon, but a country that's pursuing its own interests first. How are economic threats against Canada and Mexico, our largest and second largest trading partners, respectively, in America's interest? Asked William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. The idea of bullying friendly nations may make emotional sense to the MAGA crowd, filled with grievances, real and imagined, against our traditional allies. But tariffs are not paid by the target countries and are instead passed along to U.S. consumers and businesses. From a president who's campaigned on a promise to bring down prices, Trump's obsession with tariffs is hard to fathom. Nor will alienating our allies restore America's greatness, said David Frum in The Atlantic. To hold off China and remain the world's dominant power, we will need more and better friends than ever before. The only hope, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark, is that our allies are starting to see through Trump's nonsense. As long as they help Trump save face and claim victory, as Mexico and Canada did, it's now apparent that his threats, more often than not, will not be implemented. And American voters seem happy with these phony showdowns. It makes a certain kind of sense. Addressing real problems, whether drug trafficking or unfair trade practices, is a complicated process that requires compromise from multiple stakeholders. But when the problems are imaginary, the president can just click his fingers and fix them, like magic, which seems to be precisely what Americans want right now. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for second acts. After former President Joe Biden, 82, signed with Creative Artists Agency, the top Hollywood talent management firm, which counts Brad Pitt among its clients, to represent him in future endeavors. We are profoundly honored, said CAA co-chair Richard Lovett. It was a good week for mother issues. After Polish billionaire Roman Karkasik unveiled plans to build a towering statue of the Virgin Mary in his hometown of Kikola. At 131 feet tall, the statue will dwarf the 98-foot statue of Mary's son, Christ the Redeemer, that looms above the Rio de Janeiro. And it was a good week for nicotine fiends, who may soon have representation at the highest levels of government. Sharp-eyed C-SPAN viewers noticed Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's nominee for Health and Human Services, secretary, discreetly slipped what appeared to be a Zen nicotine patch into his mouth during his Senate confirmation hearing. But it was a bad week for trade policy after the Dallas Mavericks stunned the basketball world by trading superstar Luka Doncic, 25, to the Los Angeles Lakers for Anthony Davis, the injury-prone 31-year-old forward. Doncic says the mystifying trade came as a big shock to him personally, but he's excited to play in L.A. The fans are amazing, and I got the ocean here. It's a bad week for free-speeched absolutists. After a British woman was fined and sentenced to a year of rehabilitation sessions for harassing her boyfriend's former partner with unsolicited videos of herself breaking wind. According to prosecutors, Rhiannon Evans, 25, filmed the video messages by placing the camera on her bottom and passing the gas. Finally, it was a bad week for generosity. After Japanese police arrested a 71-year-old man who bungled 63 homes to find his love of treating strangers to free meals in expensive sushi joints. "I wanted to look cool," said Kazunori Inagaki. And the briefing, title this week, "The Battle Over TikTok." Congress voted to ban the popular app. Why does President Trump want to save it? Why is TikTok so controversial? The highly successful short-form video app is owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company based in Beijing. That gives China's communist government the ability to access the personal data of TikTok's 170 million U.S. users, about half the population. Researchers have documented that TikTok algorithm promotes pro-China propaganda and suppresses posts about topics forbidden in China, such as the government's abuse of the Uyghur minority and Taiwan independence. Calling TikTok a national security threat, the House voted 360-58 and the Senate 79-18 last year to require ByteDance to sell the app to an American company or have it removed from app stores. The Supreme Court unanimously upheld the law last month, ruling that Congress had well-supported national security concerns about TikTok's control by a foreign adversary. TikTok refused to sell and indicated it would shut down. But President Trump issued an executive order delaying the ban for 75 days while trying to persuade ByteDance to sell 50% of the U.S. app to Microsoft, Oracle, or another U.S. owner. "I have a warm spot in my heart for TikTok," Trump said. Why the warm spot? It developed recently. In 2020, Trump issued an executive order to ban TikTok, saying the app gives the Chinese Communist Party access to Americans' personal and proprietary information. That order was blocked by a federal court. Last year, ByteDance investor Jeff Yass, whose share of the company is worth more than $20 billion, personally lobbied Trump to protect TikTok and became a major contributor, donating over $96 million to Republican campaigns and PACs. During the campaign, Trump allies effectively used the site to win over young voters, and Trump amassed more than 15 million followers. Now Trump says it would be wrong to deprive TikTok users of their favorite app. "We have to save it," he said. Does China control TikTok? TikTok's Singaporean CEO, Shao Zichu, insists the Chinese government does not control the app. But ByteDance is obligated by Chinese law to have an in-house Communist Party committee. The government also owns 1% of ByteDance's main Chinese entity. BuzzFeed obtained leaked audio from internal TikTok meetings in 2022, revealing that China-based employees repeatedly accessed U.S. users' data. "Everything is seen in China," said one employee. ByteDance's refusal to sell would suggest it values influence and data more than money. What data does TikTok collect? It collects users' ages, locations, contacts, phone numbers, internet addresses, and the content of their private messages and through the app, sent through the app. Some argue this is no different from the practices of other social media companies. The system of personal data security across social media and other apps is so broken, TikTok scarcely matters, said CRN Martin, former head of the UK's cybersecurity agency. ByteDance insists that China is unlikely to demand access to its data. What about censorship? TikTok's secret sauce lies in the algorithm that determines what populates each user's feed, a never-ending video scroll called For You page. That secret algorithm grants the company immense power over what people see. Two studies by Rutgers University found that the platform promotes positive views of China's government and culture and suppresses negative content about China. In one research test, TikTok blocked a user who posted a video condemning China's mass detention of Muslims. Studies also suggest TikTok impacts users' political views and increases polarization. About 45% of 18 to 29-year-olds get most of their news from TikTok. And U.S. intelligence warned last year that China has used it to actively exploit perceived U.S. societal divisions and to foment negative views of America. How did the app get so popular? Usage surged when the pandemic stranded many people in their homes, growing from about 40 million monthly users in early 2020 to over 100 million by August that year. They're mostly young. Only 10% of adults 65 and older reported using TikTok last year, compared with 62% of those under 30. Researchers at Baylor University also found TikTok's endless video scroll was addictive for nearly 1 in 4 users, with many of them losing track of time. In October, attorneys general in 13 states and Washington, D.C. sued TikTok, arguing it violated consumer protection laws and exacerbated a teen mental health crisis by, among other things, using beauty filters that can lead viewers to develop body image issues. They deployed a suite of manipulative features that exploited young people's psychological vulnerabilities, said California Attorney General Rob Bonta. Where does TikTok stand now? Trump's extension gives ByteDance until April 5th to sell TikTok, worth an estimated $50 billion. It's been absent from App Store since January, but still works for users who already had the app downloaded. It's unclear that ByteDance will sell even half of TikTok, or that such a sale would be legal, since Congress has required a total sale to a U.S. firm. Meanwhile, TikTok influencers, whose livelihoods depend on the platform, remain in limbo. I feel like I'm going through heartbreak, said Alex Earle, a lifestyle influencer with over 7 million followers. And we'll read a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Attention's central role in politics. Attention, not money, is now the fuel of politics, said Ezra Klein. That's why President Trump, who railed against Facebook and Twitter in his first term, has aligned himself with the heads of those platforms, the titans of attention, in his second term. To win Trump over, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and Elon Musk not only gave him millions for his inauguration and his campaign, they also transformed their media platforms to be friendlier to the new president and his supporters. In return, Trump, a showman who has always intuitively understood the power of attention, granted them catbird seats at the inauguration, and in Musk's case, influence and centrality in his administration. We have not seen as clear a trade for power in the modern era, and we aren't prepared for it. If Musk uses X to flood the country with disinformation and promote the Republican Party in the 2026 midterms and 2028 presidential election, who will stop him? Powerful people with enormous concentrated wealth have largely defied efforts to control their political influence in the U.S., and for attention, the problem is worse, and we have not even begun to attempt solutions. Money didn't fix kids' learning loss. Our public education system is in dire straits, and no amount of funding seems to help, said Stephanie Lindquist Arora. 5 years after school lockdowns began, American students haven't recovered from pandemic learning loss. In fact, many are faring even more poorly than before. The 2024 National Assessment of Educational Progress last week reported testing results for the nation's fourth and eighth graders, and they were grim. The vast majority of children who took the NAEP math and reading assessments are performing below proficiency level, and reading scores actually declined to about 30% proficiency, even lower than in 2022. The Biden administration allocated $189 billion to combat learning loss, but much of it was wasted on ancillary goodies like athletic fields, a nature center, and hotel stays, as well as on equity development and other ideological projects. It's clear that simply throwing more money at public schools does not yield better results for students. More than two-thirds of fourth graders lack reading proficiency, which portends more learning problems in the future. We will need more school choice and more accountability for failing schools for American children to have a chance to succeed. This column comes from Mexico. Life in limbo at the U.S. border. Tens of thousands of people are suddenly trapped in Mexico near the U.S. border, begging for mercy to be allowed to cross, said Fabiola Mancilla Castillo. These asylum seekers were not seeking to break U.S. law. They followed the rules, using the U.S. Customs and Border Protection app to schedule appointments for the hearings that will allow them to plead their cases. But that American dream was dashed within hours of President Trump's inauguration. On his first day in office, he shut down the CBP One mobile app that the Biden administration had set up to discourage illegal border crossings. In an instant, the appointments that families had waited 12 months or more to get simply vanished. Now these people are crowding shelters or living on the streets, waiting for a miracle. Their stories are heartbreaking but familiar. Gabriela, a Mexican woman from Guerrero, can't stay here because her husband was murdered and corrupt authorities in her town let his killer walk free. Two of her children have already migrated to the U.S. Will she see them? All these people want is opportunity. But American leaders have forgotten that it was immigrants who built their nation, people who arrived on ships from Europe and invaded a land that was not theirs. And the last word, our in-depth article, The Making of a Saint. The Vatican will soon declare its first millennial saint, said Linda Kintzler in The Guardian. How did the Catholic Church decide an Italian teenager was worthy of canonization? As a child growing up in Milan, Carlo Acutis collected stories of miracles. He wrote about the time when, in 1411, wine turned to blood in a castle chapel in Ludburg, Croatia. Of how, in 1630, a pastor in Canossa, Italy, saved his town from a flood by blessing the raging waters. Of how, in 1906, a priest on the island of Tumaco, Colombia, held up a reliquary on the beach to stop an approaching tsunami. Acutis, 11 years old and a devout Catholic, began typing up these stories and posting them on his website, which he styled as a virtual museum of miraculous events. A section on the site invited visitors to discover how many friends you have in heaven and to read stories of young saints. Acutis hoped to one day join their ranks. He was convinced that he would die before he reached adulthood and told his mother, Antonio, that he would perish of a broken vein in his brain. He wanted to be buried in the town of Assisi, where his family had a summer home. In the meantime, he devoted his life to the church, which was a surprise to his largely secular parents. As a teenager, he taught catechism classes to young children and offered them a step-by-step guide to becoming a saint. "Always remember that you, too, can become a saint," he would say. Every day they were to go to Mass, recite the Holy Rosary, read the Scripture, and confess their sins. Describing what would-be saints needed to do in life, Acutis omitted mention of the significant tasks they would need to undertake in death. To be recognized as a saint, an individual must go through what is essentially a prolonged posthumous trial. The Vatican office responsible for this process is known as the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, and it has been in operation since 1588. The Dicastery investigates whether the candidate was spiritually exemplary in life and whether they have proven useful to the faithful even in death. Crucially and most controversially, every candidate must also have two scientifically inexplicable miracles posthumously attributed to them before they can be canonized. God alone can perform miracles, according to the Catholic faith. Saints merely intercede on behalf of believers. Acutis wrote extensively about his theological devotion, as if in anticipation of his own post-mortem trial. He filmed a video of himself in which he proclaimed that he was destined to die. Then, on October 1, 2006, when he was 15, he fell ill with a fever and sore throat. A pediatrician was consulted and an antibiotic prescribed, but his symptoms worsened. On October 6, he found blood in his urine. The next day, he did not have the strength to get out of bed. His parents took him to the hospital, where he was diagnosed with leukemia. He told his mother he would not make it out of the hospital alive. Over the next few days, his condition continued to decline, and a priest was summoned to his bedside. On October 11th, he suffered a cerebral hemorrhage and fell into a coma. Hours later, doctors declared him brain dead. The next day, at 6:45 a.m., his heart stopped beating. His body was transported back to his home in Milan, where loved ones gathered. He was buried in a family plot in Piedmont, while a tomb in Assisi was readied. Not long after, Acutis' belongings were handed over to a historical committee from the local archdiocese that began looking into whether he could have, in fact, been a saint. They started collecting testimonies from neighbors, friends, teachers, and priests. They pored over his internet history and extensive writings, looking for any signs of sin. In 2012, the Archdiocese of Milan opened an official process for his beatification and canonization, called a cause. The following year, the Vatican gave its first sign of approval for Acutis' candidacy, issuing an order called a nihil obstat, or nothing hinders, which grants permission for the investigation of the saintly life to proceed. The Dicastery for the Causes of Saints is located on the third floor of an imposing building on St. Peter's Square, immediately outside the Vatican's circular colonnade. its daily operations are kept out of the public eye. Father Angelo Romano, the newly appointed general relator of the dicastery, would not allow me to take photographs inside or record our conversation. And just as a prosecutor or judge cannot discuss the details of an ongoing litigation, he could not speak to me about any saintly investigations in progress. "We are a very peculiar court," he said. "There is no point when a cause will be dismissed, and there is no statute of limitations." Romano estimates that the office is now working on no fewer than 1,600 causes, some of which date back to the 15th century. Canonization has long been a way for the Catholic Church to shape its image. In Acutis, the Holy See found an avenue to connect with a younger generation. From the moment his cause was officially opened, Acutis was referred to as potentially the first millennial saint. He has been nicknamed God's influencer and the patron saint of the Internet. Few causes have proceeded as quickly as his. Today, the rules governing sainthood retain a basic structure established four centuries ago. Supporters of a would-be saint must publicize the candidate's story and virtues. In Rome, the postulator, who acts as the equivalent of a campaign manager, must submit their credentials to the dicastery for approval. After the Vatican issues the Nihil Obstat order, testimonies about the candidate's life must be submitted and then compiled into a positio. These volumes, which read a bit like legal briefs, often run to more than 1,500 pages. Next, the positio is presented to the plenum of the dicastery, a body of bishops and cardinals that serve as the office's highest court and interrogates the written account for any signs of the unholy, which can stall a cause for decades. The cause of Henriette Delisle, the founder of a New Orleans religious order, has been called into question because of a rumor that she gave birth to two sons out of wedlock. If the plenum is convinced, then the case is brought before the Pope, who determines whether the candidate can be called venerable and become the object of direct prayers from the faithful. After that, two miracles still need to be investigated and found to be scientifically inexplicable. Proof of a first miracle means that an individual can be beatified, meaning that the church recognizes their place in heaven. Only a second can make them a saint, venerated by the Universal Catholic Church. After the Pope declared Carlos Acutis venerable in 2018, the search for miracles could begin. For the faithful, the question is not whether an aspiring saint will work miracles, but when. Rumored signs of Acutis sainthood soon emerged. A group of Brazilian priests who visited his grave claimed that the rose petals they found there never wilted. When his body was exhumed in 2019, a rumor emerged that he had been found incorrupt. "He was still our big boy, 1.82 meters tall, only his skin was a little darker, with all his black curly hair," his mother told an Italian newspaper. The Archbishop of Assisi issued a statement dispelling the rumors, saying the Acutis body was found in the normal state of transformation proper to any cadaveric condition. In any case, the Church no longer considers incorrupt remains to be an indication of sainthood. In April 2019, Acutis was moved to a glass-paneled tomb inside the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore, one of the major sanctuaries in Assisi, and a live stream of the shrine was set up. His body became church property, and his remains were prepared for display. A silicon mask of his face was made to cover up signs of decay, while his heart was preserved in a golden reliquary and deposited at the nearby Cathedral of San Rufino. Pieces of his funeral shroud, cuttings of his hair, of which there were several hundred, and fragments of his organs were prepared as relics for veneration. Acutis was attired in his favorite clothing, navy blue Nikes, blue jeans, and a North Sails zip-up sweater. He was the first prospective saint to be buried in branded clothing. Since 1950, every miracle approved by the Dicasteries Medical Board, a secretive body of doctors who meet regularly to evaluate stories of divine healings, has been a physical act of healing. The advance of scientific knowledge means that fewer cures are truly inexplicable. Those alleged miracles that do make it to the Dicasteries Medical Board must be accompanied by documentation. CT scans, x-rays, blood work reports. The medical board will only recognize a miracle if, after thorough investigation, no existing scientific explanation can be found for a cure. In 2019, the Dicastery received a package from Brazil containing materials that claim to document a miracle attributed to Acutis. The healing was said to have occurred on the 7th anniversary of his death in 2013 when a 3-year-old boy named Matthias kissed a relic of Acutis' clothing that had been transferred to a chapel in Campo Grande in the Brazilian state of Mato Grosso do Sul. Matthias had been suffering from a diseased pancreas. He vomited continually and could only subsist on a liquid diet. No one expected him to live very long. At the chapel, he prayed to Acutis to be cured. Hours later, he ate a full meal of rice, beans, and steak and kept all of it down. His doctors could not explain the sudden turn, nor understand why scans showed that his pancreas appeared to have healed itself. Matthias' recovery became Acutis' first verified miracle, clearing the way for his beatification. In October 2020, 3,000 people attended the Mass in Assisi, where he was officially declared blessed, moving one step closer to sainthood. In May 2024, the medical board of the Dicastery announced that it had verified a second miracle attributed to Acutis. The healing had occurred 2 years earlier after a woman named Liliana from Costa Rica visited Acutis' tomb in Assisi. Liliana's daughter, Valeria, had fallen off her bike while she was studying at a university in Florence and had been hospitalized with severe head trauma. According to the Vatican, Valeria required craniotomy surgery and the removal of the right occipital bone to reduce pressure on her brain. At Acutis' tomb, Liliana asked him to heal her daughter. That same day, Valeria's doctors reported that she had begun breathing on her own again. A few days later, all signs of the hemorrhage had gone. Upon reviewing the incident, the medical board of the Dicastery found no scientific explanation for what had occurred. Pope Francis declared it a miracle and said that he would convene a meeting called a consistory of cardinals to formally approve Acutis canonization. After the news broke, a rush of visitors descended upon Acutis' tomb in Assisi. In a single month, 32,000 people visited the ancient chapel where he lies entombed. On July 1st, the Catholic cardinals in Rome gathered with Pope Francis in the Vatican's Apostolic Palace. After the prefect of the Dicastery, Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, presented the report on Acutis' cause, known as a peroratio, or a final plea, a vote was taken and the canonization was approved. This year at 10:30 a.m. on April 27th, the Pope will confirm Acutis' saintliness by uttering one Latin word, discernimus, or we recognize it. His name will be inscribed upon the list of saints, a print volume published by the Dicastery and reissued every year. Carlos' feast day will become part of the liturgical calendar and his memory venerated by Catholics the world over. This autumn, a fragment of Acutis' pericardium, the sac that encircles the heart, toured North America. On the day the relic visited his church, Father Peter Tyrone, a neuroscientist turned priest from the Archdiocese of Toronto, told me that he stood blessing people from 1:30 p.m. to 9:45 p.m. One couple brought their young daughter, who had severe epilepsy and was in a wheelchair. She had already begun praying to Acutis and said her symptoms had diminished. At the church, Tyrone touched the relic to her face and held it there as her parents cried before him, praying to Acutis for full healing. Now that he is set to become a saint, there will be no further medical investigations into Acutis' divine works. All that is certain is that a prayer was uttered, a relic touched, some slight relief from pain felt. Every miracle is an invitation to believe, Tyrone said. It's not the Pope, and it's not the bishop who makes the cause. It's the people. This was adapted from a story that first appeared in The Guardian. We'll pick up a couple of the health and science articles today, starting with life's building blocks in outer space. NASA's first asteroid sampling mission has delivered a bombshell. The 4.5 billion-year-old asteroid Bennu harbors many of the basic building blocks for life, including amino acids and the five main nucleobases that make up RNA and DNA. Samples from the asteroid, scraped off in space by a robotic probe and shot back to Earth in a sealed capsule to avoid being contaminated by terrestrial compounds, have now been analyzed in two new studies. They show that the Bennu samples contain not only organic molecules, but also compounds that result from briny salt water. That doesn't mean Bennu itself ever harbored life. The researchers said they found no evidence of any microscopic fossils, but it does suggest that chemistry friendly to life, including liquid water, is more common in space than astronomers thought, and that amino acids and nucleobases could have arrived on Earth through asteroid strikes. The key mineralogical and chemical material needed for life's emergence on Earth was being delivered to our planet early in its history. Geologist Michael Akerson, who wasn't affiliated with the NASA project, tells Smithsonian Magazine, effectively, Bennu's brines created a nursery for the development of complex organic molecules that were subsequently delivered to a nascent Earth. The next steps for scientists is to try to get samples from the dwarf planet Ceres, located in the asteroid belt, and from Saturn's icy moon Enceladus, which would have both shown evidence of saltwater residues. The bird flu has mutated again. A rare strain of avian flu, H5N9, has been detected for the first time in sick birds in the United States, sparking concern about the virus' ability to evolve. The variant was identified in ducks at a commercial farm in California, where the more common H5N1 strain was also present. After some 120,000 birds were culled, genetic analysis confirmed that H5N9 emerged through reassortment, a process involving the mixing of different flu strains within an infected host. The announcement of a new strain comes 3 weeks after the first bird flu-related human death in the country, in Louisiana, and a week after President Trump announced he was pulling the U.S. out of the World Health Organization, which coordinates the global response to pandemics. Officials say H5N9 is not a major threat to humans, only birds for now. But its emergence while H5N1 is spreading widely, not only in U.S. birds but also mammals, sickening hundreds of dairy herds, has heightened fears that avian flu will mutate into something more dangerous. It does suggest there's enough virus around that reassortment might become more frequent. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada, tells the Washington Post, with enough H5 in these animals and enough seasonal flu in humans, you get them together and you have a recipe for a potential pandemic virus. Flipping over to the Talking Points page, we'll start with an article titled Patel, a vindictive crackpot running the FBI? If Kash Patel's confirmation hearing last week proved anything, said former U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid in Time, it's that he cannot be trusted to run the FBI. When pressed by Democrats in a confrontational confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patel, a former federal prosecutor and a fierce loyalist of President Trump's, refused to say Trump lost the 2020 election. He also refused to say he would resign as FBI director if Trump directed him to engage in illegal conduct. Patel did state that under his leadership, there would be no retributions against Trump's adversaries. But Patel's track record is that of a MAGA fanatic who produced a song celebrating the January 6 rioters, who wrote a book with an enemies list of more than 60 deep state officials, and who vowed in 2023 to find the conspirators not just in government, but in the media. Nonetheless, with none of the 53 Republican senators likely to vote against him, Patel seems headed for confirmation. That Patel is a Trump loyalist shouldn't matter much, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. FBI directors are charged with executing the democratically elected president's law enforcement priorities. Patel is qualified for the job. He's worked as a public defender and as a staffer in the National Security Council during Trump's first term. The Bureau stands at a turning point, said Pat McMonagle in City Journal. After years of political prosecutions, morale has cratered, with just 41% of the Americans approving of the Bureau. The FBI must pivot toward crime fighting and remain apolitical. Patel could be exactly the kind of outsider that the FBI needs. Patel is a vindictive crackpot who's anything but apolitical, said David French in the New York Times. He has promoted a conspiracy theory that the FBI planned the January 6 riots. He's claimed the media helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. To show his extreme devotion to Trump, he even published a children's book in which King Donald triumphs over evil plotters with the help of a wizard named Kash. With a 10-year term at the FBI, Patel will have an enormous amount of unchecked power to investigate and prosecute election officials, Justice Department, and FBI officials who investigated Trump, and anyone he deems an enemy of his king. Every Republican senator who votes for Patel is abdicating his or her constitutional responsibility. We'll read some of the shorter notes. President Trump spent 7 hours and 44 minutes talking on camera in his first week back in office and spoke 81,235 words, more words than in Macbeth, Hamlet, and Richard III combined, and nearly three times as many as President Joe Biden spoke in his first week. White House staff have discussed hiring more stenographers to keep up with Trump's verbiage. Among American women born in 1930, about 80% of those with and those without a college education were married by age 45. Among women born in 1980, 71% with a college education were married by 45, compared with 52% of those without. The Defense Department has ordered NBC, NPR, Politico, and the New York Times to vacate their dedicated offices in the Pentagon. They will be replaced by three right-leaning outlets, Breitbart, the New York Post, and One American News Network, and one, HuffPost, that does not have a Pentagon correspondent and did not request a space. The shift is part of a rotation program to broaden access, said the department. As part of its crackdown on DEI across the federal government, The Trump administration is deleting any mention of the words diversity, equity, and inclusion. That has led the Internal Revenue Service to remove references in an employee handbook to the potential inequity of holding on to a taxpayer's money and the inclusion of a taxpayer ID number on a form. Wow. On the poll watch, 70% of Americans believe that corruption, inefficiency, and red tape are major problems for the federal government. But just 29% approve of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, and only 23% support eliminating entire federal agencies. 52% have an unfavorable view of Musk, while 36% view him favorably. And we've time for a couple of quotes. The first comes from Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, "The separation of powers was adopted by the Convention of 1787 not to promote efficiency, but to preclude the exercise of arbitrary power." And on a lighter note, Ernie Banks, quoted in Country Living, says, "The only way to prove that you're a good sport is to lose." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.